Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Hemlock Hollow by Cully Holderfield. Narrated by Elizabeth Ashby. Prologue. He remembered when they built the cabin. Oxen from three farms towed in hewn chestnut. Groups of four men heaved each log into place. Young boys mixed the mortar to chink the gaps, and the nimblest went atop to tamp down the tin roof. He'd been there the entire time, was still there years later, watching the cabin give way to the mountain. Years after it was built, a young girl came round with her family. She scampered among the boulders and trees like a wild-born creature. She reminded him of the first girl, and something long since froze up inside of him thawed. He once tried to reach out to her. It's one thing for folks to be afraid of you. It's altogether another to not be believed in. That smarts for the dead and the living alike. Time ain't nothing to the dead, but it's everything to a structure made by hand. Folks came and went, some that weren't supposed to be there, some that were. He'd watched the floorboards go soft and the windows crack and the shiny tin roof rust clean through. Were he able to wield a hammer and saw, he would sister the decayed girder and shim up the cantered stair and seal the leak in the loft. He can't, though. All he can do is wait for the day when she will return, and he knows she will. A love like that can't be gotten rid of. 1. The box wasn't much to look at. Old in metal, at one point it had probably been gray. Over the years, it had oxidized green. There were three clasps on the front, now corroded with grit and rust. Mika and his crew had discovered it in the attic and had carted it through the old cabin to the card table we had set up out back. Decades of dirt and dust left a trail through the loft, down the stairs, and up the hill. More crumbled onto the tarp I had laid out. My family had owned the cabin for my entire life, and I had never seen this box before. It had been sitting in an attic I didn't know existed, waiting to be found for who knows how long.
"What do you say, Caroline?" Mika asked, wiping his brow with a bandana. He tugged at his scraggly beard. "Should we open it?"
I pondered whether to toss the box and its mystery contents into the giant waste bin out front, or to open it and take the plunge into a dark past that I had spent a lifetime trying to escape. Down the hill, Mika's crew continued with their demolition work, their sledgehammers echoing through the hollow. Up the mountain, a crow cawed.
"Well?" Mika asked. "I can get a crowbar."
I sighed, my reluctance giving way to curiosity and compulsion. "If you get me a blowtorch and a flathead screwdriver, I can open this. I am an archaeologist, after all."
"That's so?"
His eyes widened. He took off his Wilco hat and ran a hand through his untamed hair.
"Like Indiana Jones?"
Everyone's favorite archaeologist was in no way an archaeologist, but rather than lecture my general contractor, I shook my head. "No, more interpretive than old Indy. Less running from boulders and ghosts, more thinking about the ancient stars and writing about them."
"You best watch what you say. Opening that box may release the spirit of the hollow."
He chuckled, winked, and plunged down the mountain to his old pickup truck. I laughed at his joke, but that was exactly what I was afraid of. The summer I turned 12, Dolores Appleton and Martha Boston, my two best friends at the time, had come up from Greensboro to spend the month of July at the cabin with me. We all shared a double bed upstairs. Oh, the late-night conversations we had. Even now in middle age, I blush at the suppositions we made about sex and boys and romance. Late one night, Dolores and Martha had dozed off. I knew this because Dolores snored, and Martha had the deep breathing of the truly asleep. I woke, having to use the bathroom. It was so dark that I couldn't tell if I'd opened my eyes or not. I pushed down the covers and tuned my senses to the night. Outside, a breeze rustled the tall hemlocks. A spray of needles and tiny cones skittered down the tin roof. Katydids, so raucous in the early evening, had quieted to a low dirge. Everyone lay fast asleep,
Mom and Dad in their bedroom on the main floor, Andrew, my brother, in his bedroom across from mine upstairs, the girls in the bed with me. The only bathroom was downstairs. As I steeled myself to climb from the bed, the old stairs creaked as if someone were coming up. I swiveled my head to better listen. Another step squeaked. Higher this time. Closer. I waited, clenching my urgent bladder. The next step let out a long and drawn-out sigh as if the climber had sunk a heavy foot slowly. My mind ran through the possibilities. It could be my father climbing up to check on us. I waited for his balding head to emerge in the stairwell. Another step followed, this time barely perceptible. My heart pounded. A step creaked near the top of the stairs. Maybe it was my mother. As if on cue, everything fell silent, even the katydids outside. The air stilled. All the hair on my body stood straight. A bone-deep chill chased the covers up my neck. I was overcome with the sense that somebody was in the room with us, somebody who wasn't family, and who wasn't exactly alive. The visage of a bearded, sorrowful man in a brown suit flashed through my mind like an afterimage. Anguish seized me. I had never felt anything like that before. A 12-year-old should never feel such despair. He was standing at the end of the bed. Though I didn't dare look, I knew he was there. I buried my face in my pillow. He moved beside me, his breath heavy in my ear. I shuddered at the 30-year-old memory. I wiped my sweaty palms on my jeans and returned my attention to the box. I hadn't worked with artifacts since grad school. These days I spent a lot of time looking at the stars from sites where ancient peoples had done the same thing. But I did remember a trick or two. I began chipping away at the crust of the thing. Soon Mika returned with the blowtorch and screwdriver and handed both to me. I lit the blowtorch, which induced a broad grin. "Nice," he said, far too enthralled at my ability to work a tool. I held the torch just close enough that the metal on the three clasps started to expand. "You don't by chance have any liquid nitrogen, do you?" I asked. He scrunched his eyes. "No." I killed the torch. Without chemicals, I'd have to apply brute force. Using the screwdriver, I worked the clasps until they gave way. I slid the lid up, moving it bit by bit until it let go and popped open. My heart jumped. Dozens of pairs of eyes caught the light of day. They searched the world from a scattering of old photos. Nestled among the photos was a journal. It was leather-bound, stained at the edges, but cinched tight. Seeming to understand the importance of the moment, Mika left me alone with the past. I removed my work gloves and replaced them with a pair of latex gloves from my first aid kit. I picked up the journal and weighed it in my hands. Made of high-quality leather, it had a rawhide tassel that held its flaps shut in a protective hug. Despite the gloves and the heat, my hands were trembling. Whose fingers had last touched this journal? Who had tied this bow knot that I was now delicately undoing? I separated the ends of the rawhide and opened the book. The first page bore a fine penciled drawing of a boulder-strewn creek surrounded by giant, perfectly rendered hemlocks. Looking back up the hollow, I knew it was a depiction of this very place. The second page was titled, "The Journal of Carson J. Quinn." Carson Quinn. The name echoed across the chasm of time, all the way back from my childhood. Carson Quinn. I remembered. He was the murderer. The Journal of Carson J. Quinn. January 3rd, 1886. Gramps gave me this journal for Christmas this winter, and I'm just now getting down to putting something in it. I'm not much for writing, so I was not quite sure what to do with it. It's right nice, practically waterproof. I imagine Mr. Charles Darwin had something similar on his voyage on the Beagle. He would need as much waterproofing as possible, what with all the storms and oceans and other perils. I'm only 13 and must content myself to wanderings I can do on foot. One day, I'll set out on some fantastical voyage to Yon, like Mr. Darwin, and this journal might well accompany me. Gramps has everything Mr. Darwin has ever written in his library. He has lots of other books as well. Being a lawyer and all, he has shelves of law books, like Blackstone's Commentaries and such. He also has all the ancient classics, like Plato, Aristotle, Cicero, and St. Augustine. Of these I have little interest. But I've read nearly all of his natural history collection, André and François Michaud's books on Oaks, Flora, and Silva of North America, von Humboldt's Travels to the New World, William Bartram's Travels, the travel accounts of John Lawson, Thomas Harriot, and Mark Catesby, and all of the books he has by Thoreau and Emerson. One day, I shall travel into the great wilderness like these men. Until then, I shall content myself with what wild bounty exists around me here in Daisy. Reading the words sent a shiver down my spine. My mind spun backward, back to the first time I heard about Carson Quinn decades ago. As a family, we had ventured one afternoon up the state road toward the Duncan homestead. The Duncans owned the prized bottomland up the cove. Saunter Branch cut past an old two-story clapboard house in the middle of a meadow. At some point, that house had been quite the residence, but by the 80s its tin roof was rusted, its walls were porous, and the paint had been scoured away by the elements. Where corn and tobacco fields had once surrounded the home, briars and milkweed grew. We approached the fence out front. "Hello, the house?" Daddy called from the road, mimicking how locals would greet one another from afar. "Ed, you up there?" Old Man Duncan never did much more than rock on his front porch. If you didn't announce yourself from a distance, you were likely to inspire his other favorite pastime of blasting away with the double-barreled shotgun that always accompanied him. "For the law, should it ever come," he'd always explain. "Hello, the road," came the reply. "Dan, is that you?" "Yes, sir," Dad said. "Come on up, let's have ourselves a visit," the old man said, delighted to have guests. "I just opened a jar of 56. The porch moaned with our weight. The old man with creased eyes and a wayward white beard motioned us to sit. Mom cleared off some rabbit hides from a bench to give us space. "Oh, you could just set them aside somewhere," Old Man Duncan said. He handed Daddy a mason jar, then poured it full of a pungent, clear liquid. "Try it, Dan. It ain't gonna drink itself." Daddy took a sip. His eyes got big. He coughed and shook his head like a dog that had gotten into a yellow jacket's nest. "Whew!" he finally said in a high-pitched voice I had never heard before. Old Man Duncan lit into a fit of knee-slapping laughter at his response. He turned to Mom. "Madeline, you care for any of my finest?" He held out the bottle. "No, Ed," she said. "I think Daniel prefers me without hair on my chest." That sent the old man into another laughing spell that wound slowly down into a spate of coughing. Aside from drinking and blasting away at the law, Ed Duncan's next favorite pastime was storytelling. "Well, well," he said, squinting at me. "Little missy." He took a breath and cocked his head as if trying to remember something. "Caroline!" Andrew blurted out before I realized that Mr. Duncan was tripping over my name. I was as shy with people as I was confident in the woods, but Andrew had never met a stranger. He loaded his gums with a wad of tobacco. "Yes, yes, yes, little Miss Caroline with the purty name for a purty face. What can mean old Ed Duncan do for a sweet thing such as yourself?" Emboldened by his kindness, I asked, "Who lived in our cabin before us?" He worked his tobacco for a bit, then commenced. "That cabin of yours was built for Marinda Quinn," he said. "She was a young widow at the time. The Quinns lived down by the hardtop in the Grayson place. Course it weren't a hardtop then." The Grayson's place was the nicest house around. It was a white, two-story wooden house nestled by a waterfall on Saunter Branch. Out behind the house once stood a grist mill. The only evidence that remained of the mill were two huge millstones that we used to climb on and around when my parents visited with the Graysons. Widow? Mom asked.
That's right, Mr. Duncan allowed. Her husband was slain. She finished her years in the old yellow house down on the hardtop.
Slain as in murdered? Mom asked, frowning.
You know of another kind?
The old man spat a string of tobacco juice into a Folger's coffee tin at his feet. It rang like a struck bell. I guess not, Mom said. Old Man Duncan continued.
She was the purtiest thing ever, even as she got up in years. I ain't ashamed to tell it to the world I was smitten. We all was. But boy, was she trouble.
Mr. Duncan sat back in his chair and looked up at the mountainside. He started rocking in silence, his mind searching. Trouble? Dad asked.
There were two brothers, you see, Carson and Thomas Quinn, and both was in love with her. Thomas wound up marrying her, had a daughter with her. 10 years later, he winds up shot dead.
By Carson? Mom asked.
Officially, no. You see, Thomas was not well-liked. The list of suspects could have been put together by the census taker, and it included some extremely violent men. None was ever charged due to lack of evidence, but everybody knew Carson did it, on account of Miranda.
My young mind was struggling to keep up with it all. Andrew, Daddy suddenly scolded, put that down. I looked over, and Andrew was in a staring contest with some creature's skull. He had picked it up and held it at eye level. Son, Mom said, that's not Yorick and you're not Hamlet. Sorry, Mr. Duncan.
That's all right, young'un, he said, already starting to chuckle at the joke he was about to make. That there cat done learned its lesson about curiosity. I reckon we all got to someday.
This is a cat? Andrew asked, turning the skull in his hand.
Was, the old man answered.
Andrew set the skull back down, wiping his hands on his jeans.
Where was I? Mr. Duncan continued. Miranda. Miranda only lived in that cabin of yours for a year or so before they moved her down to the house by the road. After that, Carson Quinn himself lived alone there for years. About as likable as a timber rattler, but smart as all dickens. He could tell you the names of everything, plants, animals, trees, rocks, in Latin even. He had been places, seen things, knew all sorts of languages and customs from all over the world. The burdens he carried were heavy, and he never did cotton to the Lord, so I reckon he carries 'em still.
Daddy took another sip of his drink. This time he was careful, and it didn't cause him to spew or cough. So he wasn't church-going?
No siree, the old man said. It was one thing for him to be a likely murderer, that folks might understand, but the rumor was he was one of them there, what do you call a person don't believe in God?
An atheist? Mom tripped slightly over the words. She was a devoted church-goer, making us attend the local church, sometimes even on vacation. Ed Duncan nodded and spat disgustedly into the can. So none of these Quinns were well-liked, Dad surmised.
I reckon Miranda was, but she were Quinn by marriage alone. All goes back to the war, I suppose.
The Civil War? Dad asked. Old Man Duncan narrowed his gaze.
The War of Northern Aggression.
How so? Dad asked.
The Quinns were enemies of secession, he said, as if still affronted by an event that had transpired a century before. They fought for the Union.
Mr. Duncan trailed off into silence.
My understanding is that that wasn't uncommon up here, Dad said. There were Union counties around here.
I eyed that shotgun for fear the old man was about to fire off the final two shots of the war. He worked a bit on his tobacco, took a long pull from his jug, and finally let out a distasteful,
"Reckon so."
I held Carson Quinn's journal in my hand, distant past and present slamming hard together. I didn't know what I thought would be in the box, but certainly not a murderer's journal. I laid it down and turned my attention to the other contents of the box.
There were the photos. Some appeared older than the cabin itself. They crumbled in my hands, so I spread them carefully onto a flattened-out newspaper. A somber family stared back. In one photo, a dashing young man gazed confidently into the distance, his pressed soldier's uniform sporting a chest full of shiny medals. There was a similar photo, but much older, of a severe-looking man who appeared to be a Union soldier from the Civil War. He seemed as stern as a sphinx. One photo featured a large group of people. The bride and groom at the center suggested it was a wedding. The guests were spread out across the wide stone steps of a massive white house, bigger than any residence in Hickory Nut Gap. The somber brood gazed from behind the happy couple. Another photo showed what appeared to be four generations of a family sitting on a wide porch. Not a single one of them wore a smile. Their clothes were dark. The women had dresses that covered every inch of their bodies from ankle to chin. The men all wore suits and bolo ties with slicked down hair and various stages of beards. My heart jumped. There, in the back row, stood a scowling young man with a dark beard. I could feel his breath on my neck. He was calling from beyond the grave. That was him, the ghost. His eyes bore into my own. When I placed the picture aside, he alone from the group of people seemed to track me. My arms bristled with goosebumps. I covered the photo and looked away into the tops of the swaying hemlocks. 2. January 8, 1886. My family consists of my parents, William and Sheila Quinn, my older sister, Sarah Ann, my brothers, Thomas and Taylor, and the aforementioned Gramps, Aurelius Quinn. Then there is myself, Carson J. Quinn, born on Saunter Branch in Henderson County, North Carolina, in 1873. The children go like this. Sarah's the oldest at 17, then comes Thomas, who's 15, then me, age 13, then Taylor, who's 11. I don't know how old Ma and Pa are, but Gramps is older than the hills and just as tough. He's old enough to have fought under General Taylor in the Mexican-American War. After Santa Anna took his leg, he came home to practice law. Don't ever talk to Gramps about Texas. He says we'd have been better off letting the Mexicans have it. Everybody loves Gramps. He's a hero in these parts. Not for what he did in the war, but for all that he's done after. Pa is just the opposite. Some folks downright revile him on account of the fact that he wore blue instead of gray in the war, some folks being primarily the Duncans. It doesn't bother me. My pa just knows how to pick a winner's all. It was in New York once the war was over that Pa met Ma. She was fresh off the boat from Dublin. New York was bad then, dirty and riotous with all the soldiers. Pa told her about the rolling Blue Ridge, and they married and she came home with him, thinking it would be like bonny old Sligo. I guess it's enough like it, because she seems happy here. Today, I went out to the stable and fed Henry the mule. Henry is older than Taylor, so he's seen cold winters before. I knew he mighty appreciated the oats I gave him, even though he didn't indicate as much. Pa runs a hominy mill out behind the house. He also has a forge where he does blacksmithing. He's the best smith in all a Hickory Nut Gap, and people come to him to make and mend all manner of things. We had a huge snowstorm with nearly a foot of snow a couple of days ago. The cold cracked the water wheels, so Pa made Thomas and me fix it. He doesn't let a little cold or a lot of snow stop progress. With him, everything's always got to be working perfectly or he's not content. We fixed it, and then I went on a walk up the cove. So as Pa wouldn't think I was wasting time, I carried the shotgun in case I saw any game. Pa would never hunt himself. He hasn't touched a gun of any sort since the war. There's nothing like being out after a good snow. The world rests quiet and changed. It's like being alone in a church. I crunched through the snow up the mountain. In times past, there were all manner of creatures in these mountains, panthers, wolves, even bison and elk. At least, that's what the old folks say. Nowadays, bears and bobcats are about all that's left, and you have to go far afield to find them. Every once in a while, you'll see a deer, but not often. What I like about meandering about in the snow is you can really tell what creatures abound in these parts by their tracks. Anyhow, as I ventured up the mountain, I kept a-glancing all about in the snow, looking for signs. Some folks, well, most folks, I reckon, are fine without the panthers and wolves. Me? I'd love to be the one to see a big old paw print at the edge of Saunter Branch. I'd be like Darwin finding the Megatherium, except the Megatherium, which is a prehistoric sloth, was extinct when he found its fossil. The panther and the wolf aren't extinct, not yet at least. Today, nobody was out at the Saunters place as I passed by. Smoke curled out of the chimney, but I heard no noises within. Then I passed by the Duncan's clapboard house as quickly as possible. Old Isaac Duncan doesn't care for us Quinns much. It has to do with the war and all. On up beyond the Duncan place is pure mountain. No people at all a-living up there. I went way up, as far as I could, all the way to where there was no more up to go. From there, I could see all the way out to Hickory Nut Gap, out past Blue Rock Mountain to Round Top in the distance. Everything was pure white. It's funny how things look different in the winter, and especially in the snow. Off to the west, way on down, was a patch of dark green I hadn't noticed before. It lay tucked in the fold of the mountains about where Big John Creek would be if you were to follow it up from the mill. It was a mile or so distant from where I was, but I could tell the trees were taller than normal and still green this deep in winter. I thought they were most likely a stand-up pine, but I wanted to check, so I detoured over that way on my way home. On making my way down there, through drifts of snow nearly as deep as I am tall, and I stand nearly 6 feet tall, I discovered an enchanted place. It's a cove I had somehow never encountered previously in all my wanderings. The trees, mostly hemlocks, must be ancient because they are massive. It would take two or three of me to wrap arms around the smallest one. A little creek, a tributary to Big John Creek, meandered through and scattered all around were massive boulders as big as the smokehouse. The creek, being frozen, was silent. The only sound was a whispering wind high up in the tops of the hemlocks. Surrounding the cove on three sides was a dense laurel hill. You wouldn't be able to find this place during the summer unless you came up the creek, which I knew had some pretty steep falls on down the mountain. Mr. Darwin might describe this place in geologic terms and talk about glaciers and Laurentian rock and sediment. But for me, it was not on a religious experience. The place seemed like no other I'd ever been. I had the feeling I had discovered something no one else knew about. I hereby named the place Hemlock Hollow and decided that it would be my church. My worship, as it were, consisted of silent observation. Though the temperature was well below freezing, I did not feel cold. I was enraptured. I squatted by the creek and noted the following tracks: raccoon, Procyon loader, chickadee, titmouse, bobcat, Lynx rufus. I don't know the proper names for the birds. The raccoon had come down from the laurel hill where it was most likely bedded down for a spell, as raccoons are apt to be. The bobcat came in along the creek, picked up the coon's scent, and followed it down the creek, then back up into the hill. The birds, well, I'm not good enough to track a bird in flight. Yet. I may have been in the little hollow for an hour before I decided it was time to make my descent to the house. Getting down was tricky. There's probably a way to go straight from the hollow to the house, but you'd have to be a monkey and swing from tree to tree to do it. The mountain's too steep and the rhododendron too dense, especially in deep snow. For a human to get out, one has to trek back up the mountain to find a sure path to the east to go back down and around. Doing so brings you back by the Duncan place, and old Isaac Duncan was outside when I passed by. "Howdy do," I said. "I figure he can be ornery all he likes, but it doesn't mean I have to be."
"Afternoon," Mr. Duncan answered.
He had a bucket and a pick, and he was on his way to his spring house. "Mighty cold," I offered. Mr. Duncan grunted, perhaps that's his way of agreeing, and cleared his throat.
"You tell your pa if his shote gets in my corn again, I'm going to roast it on a spit, you hear?"
"Yes, sir," I said, seeing as how pa
Sample complete. Ready to continue?